Good morning, and welcome into the Blitz live here on Fan Run Radio, 1340 AM, 105.7 FM. It's Friday, June 2nd. I'm your host, Charlie Collier. Across from me today, Matthew Gill, as we round out the week, get you to your last lunch break of the week, spending the next 2 hours with you. It's game day. The wait's over. It's been quite the wait from the period where Tennessee got knocked out of Hoover last Tuesday to now. Been a long wait, but wait's over, and we got a college baseball game today, and a very, very important one. We also, because of course we did, we finally got some schedule news yesterday. Not necessarily the final answer we were hoping for, but at least we got an answer out of SEC meetings. Of course, we had game one of the NBA Finals last night. The Stanley Cup is happening this weekend, and there's a lot going on in Oklahoma City, too. So, whole lot to get into on today's show, but before we do, Matthew, how you doing today? Got anything going? Got any big weekend plans?
Yeah, so yesterday I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do this weekend. I guess I'll just play golf. I totally forgot I'm going to Railbird, so that's going to rule.
That's a crazy thing to just casually forget you were doing.
And as soon as I walked out the door, I was like, why did I say that, dude? You're going to Railbird, which is going to be awesome. I'm super psyched.
So you're part of the problem.
I am absolutely part of the problem. If there is a story that comes out of Lexington this weekend of, like, mass infrastructural failure, I will be part of that because it's going to be a madhouse. I've already told my girlfriend we are not going to even try and fight these crowds. Don't look at any kind of restaurant reservations. We are going to the festival, and we are going to stay away from all the rest of this nonsense and insanity that's going to be going on in Lexington. It is obviously the regional that Kentucky is going to be hosting. It is Railbird. There's a state baseball tournament and softball tournament. There are
track
no,
and field.
There track also. And field. Yeah, excuse me. Do not leave them out either. There are no hotel.
You know how many
rooms.
People are on those track teams?
Yeah,
so many.
Plenty, and it is going to be a madhouse.
There's also just a big jazz festival that attracts like 40,000 in Danville.
Okay.
Less than an hour away, so a lot of people staying in Lexington for that.
I did not realize that, yes. All that to say, hotels are at a premium. We're lucky that we booked so far ahead of time, not even realizing that all this was going to happen. Like, I just figured out, like, on Tuesday that all these other things were going on in Lexington.
You should have sold it, honestly.
Yeah. No, it could definitely go for a pretty penny. One of my best friends who is coming with us, he and his girlfriend accidentally only booked a hotel room for Saturday night. And they were like, yeah, I guess we'll just figure it out once we get there. And I was like, you're not.
I think you should probably offer them.
You are not going to figure it out once
you get
there.
Offer them some space in your room for like $50.
Yeah, no, I think the thing is, they are like professional festival people. They are pros at this. They have no qualms about sleeping in their car by any means. I'm happy to have Lucas stay in my room. If he can catch the floor, he is more than welcome to it.
You can get a cot.
And it won't be the first time that he has done something like that. I'm not worried about them at all. They're resourceful people. As I said, incredibly good festival goers. He went to Railbird last year. This is my first time going. He went last year. He said it was so poorly run. You couldn't bring any water in, anything like that. It was on like a freshly paved pavement parking lot, and it was 90 degrees out. He was waiting two hours in line for water, and people were just dropping, passed out from heat exhaustion,
that is
from dehydration.
A ringing endorsement to go back the next year.
And then once people would pass out, people in line would cheer because it meant there were less people in line they had to wait for. So people are getting like taken away by medical crews, and people are cheering for it. Go ahead.
You're telling me he went through that and thought, let's do it again.
Coming back.
Run it back.
And here's the best part, Charlie, is this guy is a big jam band fan, goes to Dead & Co. all the time, loves Fish, all these different jam bands. He is not even remotely excited for Zach Bryan and Tyler Childers, who are the big names of
this. Who's he going to see?
A band called Goose, who most people listening to this, I'm guessing you, and even myself before he played it for me, have never heard of.
Never in
but
my life.
But he is only excited for Goose, which, like, I just have to tip my hat to him. Like, if you love music so much that you're just like Tyler Childers and Zach Bryan, like, whatever, I'm going to see Goose. Like, I'm psyched for him. And he's fired up anyway. He's going to have a great time. But anyway, so I was thinking a lot about music yesterday, and I got in a little bit of a wormhole here, and I want to get your take on this. Like, where do you stand with Taylor Swift? Where are you at on the Swiftie
scale? She's the worst. I despise Taylor Swift. Actually, I don't know if I despise her. I don't like the whole everything around Taylor Swift.
It's a lot.
It's too much for me. I don't think she's – I mean, I guess when it comes down to her specifically, I actually respect the heck out of her.
Incredible career.
I mean, I have so much respect for her. She seems to be a pretty kind person.
Mm.
She seems to be a very giving person. I appreciate her dedication to, like, her fans and making everybody happy.
Definitely.
And, like, I know in Nashville she paid a bunch of fines and paid everyone's overtime to, like, go on stage at midnight after a weather delay after they told her to shut it down, just for everyone that, you know, paid to go to that concert.
Yeah.
And I got to respect, too, someone that has the entrepreneurial abilities.
It's incredible.
To turn mediocre songwriting, mediocre looks, and and mediocre singing into, like, superstardom, transcendent of, like, a generation.
And specifically right now, this is what got me thinking about it, because I'm kind of indifferent to the whole thing, and I couldn't tell you one of her songs besides Love Story, which came out when I was probably
like a couple of those, like, Tim McGraw, Love Story,
yes, and those came out
Teardrops
when, like,
on My Guitar. I like that.
And those came out when we were like 6th, 7th grade, it feels like,
yeah,
like so long ago. And she has this incredible staying power. I've not listened to one of her songs off these newer albums. But as you said, that's what has really intrigued me, and why I brought it up is the business acumen that she has and the social media, like, intelligence that she operates with. And she just has gripped, I feel like, my Twitter and all social media, the Instagram clips. And it's so smart because, like, so my deep dive has basically been, like, why yesterday was, like, why is this Eras Tour just completely taken over? And it's like she every night is, like, changing up, you know, it's basically the same show, but every night she has two different songs she plays acoustically. She's bringing out these different guest stars, like Ice Spice being with
she dropped a song with Ice Spice. It was the worst thing I've ever heard.
But
she was just like, karma is a cat sitting in my lap, karma is the breeze floating through the trees. And I was like, this is... And then I'll talk to, like, my soon-to-be sister-in-law. Brother's getting married in, like, 2 weeks. And she's like, she's just a lyrical genius.
It's
she
crazy.
Writes all her own songs, and they're just so relatable. And that's what every Taylor Swift fan sounds like. Like, I'll talk to her about it, but I hear that from all the other Taylor Swift fans. Like, her songwriting is just so relatable, and it's genius. She writes all her own songs, and it's amazing, and it's next level, and it's some of the best I've ever heard in my life, and the best lyrics I've ever heard, and that show was, like, life-changing, and it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, it's wild. She has gripped not only, like, the women our age and younger, she also has women older. And then the thing that has shocked me, and it kind of goes to the Ice Spice thing, is, like, she has flipped this narrative, though, where, like, I think we are in the minority. Like, you see all these, like, athletes and superstars and famous celebrities who, like, are going to these shows and are now calling themselves Swifties.
I think with anyone famous, though, you can't trust anything they actually publicly, you know, like, put out like that.
Okay. But, like,
you got to ask yourself every time you see, like, an athlete doing something, though, do they actually enjoy Taylor Swift, or are they just doing what's cool to be cool because they are cool?
That's true. It is a place to just, like, to show up and be seen and get your Taylor Swift fit off and post the picture. Mac Jones is specifically who I'm thinking of right now. That's the picture I can visualize.
Looking at,
like,
this Railbird lineup, though.
Yeah, Weezer, Sheryl Crow. I saw Weezer.
Zach Bryan, Tyler Childers, great.
Yeah, obviously that's the headline.
Let's see. Friday, Saturday. Saturday, Zach Bryan. I don't like him as much as I think a lot of people do.
Figured you wouldn't, yeah.
I like him, but just not as much.
I love him.
I feel like,
absolutely,
to me, some of his songs, like, run together too much, and I don't know. I like him a lot, but I'm not like head over heels for him.
I would say he's my favorite. He's definitely my most listened to if you look at my stats.
Weezer, that's going to be fun. Love Whiskey Myers.
Yeah, Whiskey Myers is good.
Charlie Crockett.
Charlie Crockett, also good. Yes.
And Morgan Wade, pretty solid too.
Morgan Wade from Johnson City.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yes. And, okay. Yeah, there's a kid from my high school that plays in her band. Excited for her.
Don't recognize any of the other names on
is
down.
Is Goose on there? Is that a Saturday thing?
Goose is Sunday.
So that's the band my buddy's fired
Sunday
up.
Sunday you got, yeah, Tyler Childers looks great.
It's going to be
Nathaniel Ratliff and the Night Sweats.
Yes.
Solid. They sang the national anthem last night.
Oh, okay.
Did not know that they were Denver natives.
I didn't even catch that.
That threw me off. Oh, the Head and Heart. All right. Ricky Skaggs. Charles Wesley Godwin.
Yeah, it's going to be a fun
Flip
time.
Turn? Wait, Flip Turn? I feel like that doesn't fit in.
I'm not familiar with their
genre.
Game.
Okay.
Flip Turn? Not
Cole really. Chaney. I like Cole Chaney. I saw him open for somebody one time.
Okay.
On Sunday, make sure you find this one. 49 Winchester. You listen to them, right?
I assume so
because they're from like your neck of the woods.
And my girlfriend's cousin is their guitar player. So yes, we are 49 fans.
Okay, good. I was going to say they are
very good. It's awesome how much success they've had. They're opening for Luke Bryan in Europe.
That's pretty sick.
Yeah, they've made a massive jump.
I saw them in Knoxville opening up for Flatland Calvary.
Oh, nice.
And
how'd you like them?
They were better than Flatland, and
I really like
Flatland too. Did not 49 Winchester is one of my favorite like bands in the world.
If you have looked at the map and seen where Mac McClung is from, which is also in that area, the 49 Winchester crew is like 20 minutes even deeper into the woods past Gate City. So like, it's a rural area that some of those guys are from. It's wild, but they're awesome, man. They're really talented.
Oh yeah, So I've seen a lot of country musicians live, Garth Brooks and Toby Keith and Tyler Childers and Turnpike Troubadours and Flatland Calvary and Cody Johnson and I could Luke Combs, like I could go on, Riley Green and just over and over and over, Eric Church.
Yeah.
49 Winchester right there for me with Cody Johnson and Tyler Childers as the best I've ever seen live.
Wow. Okay. That's high praise.
Yeah, so I have very high praise for them.
I think they're excellent.
Tell your girlfriend's cousin that they are killing
shred.
It.
They're excellent. Super happy for all their success. It's awesome. From small town where I am from. Also, discovered this yesterday. This is a total tangent, and we can get back to Robert in just a second if you want. But do you know the little kid from It? His name escapes me. I can't even remember.
Maybe.
Did you watch It? The movie?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, like he's kind of the main kid, kind of a rounder face. He is also from Bluff City, which is right outside Bristol. And we had this celebrity drag race at the Bristol Motor Speedway this week, and he was there, which I thought was hilarious. Can't think of that kid's name at all. But anyways, so I'm fired up for Railbird. It's going to be an awesome weekend, both of us, just being a couple road dogs. Can't wait to see what the weekend has for us. You fired up for the weekend?
Very much.
Yeah.
That was a long tangent on Railbird there. But.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I wanted to get your Taylor Swift thing because I thought that was the case. But just I want to tip my hat to her, as you said, incredible business acumen.
It's another weekend of the tour, another weekend of the social media posts.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing was this new boyfriend she's got from 1975. Apparently, like, some people think it's a fake relationship. She's just setting it up to basically promote new music and like fire her fans up to be like, oh man, he's no good for her, and like that's trouble. And it goes back to what you're saying, like I think there's a lot of similarities between Taylor Swift and LeBron, where like we were so aware of them in their teenage years.
That's actually really and strong.
Yeah, and you look at how their careers have gone since then, like it's an undeniable success story and massive, massive numbers put up, and it's almost the fans of these people that you get more annoyed with than it is the person themselves, like the people who vehemently defend LeBron and defend Taylor Swift and are so obsessed with them as people who can, as you said, be kind of corny and cringe at times, Taylor Swift and LeBron both. But, like, there are people that will defend them to their grave, and their identity is so wrapped up in these two people. There's a ton of similarities there. So, yeah, I spent a large percent of my day yesterday thinking about Taylor Swift, but at the end of the day, I tip my hat to her and just say, music's not for me, but you are an incredible success, and I think we're looking at the summer of Taylor Swift. This is not slowing down anytime soon, Charlie.
All right, summer of Taylor Swift, but it's game day today. So, with that being said, we'll go ahead and catch a break. We'll talk the SEC news of the day first, and then later on we'll get into the Tennessee and Clemson regional. Man, leaving here at about 12:05. Say goodbye to y'all at noon and hit the road by about 12:05. So I'm fired up. Fired up to be hitting the road. It's been a minute since I've gotten my road trip to an away game fixed, just due to some like scheduling circumstances. Last time I think I've traveled for a game was in December going to Arizona.
And that's not like you.
Yeah, it's been a minute, so I'm jacked up to get to a new city, get some new experiences. If anyone's in Clemson too, hit me up. I'll come hang out with you. Catch a break here though. And on the other side, SEC is going to an 8-game schedule in 2024. We'll talk about it.
Linderman Sports Medicine of Memphis is the South's leader in orthopedic regenerative medicine.
All right, back here on the Blitz. King Mason to play us back in. So the SEC made a decision. Kind of. As the announcement made yesterday, the SEC for 2024 and for 2024 only will be moving, well, not moving, but approving an 8-game schedule. So the SEC is not adding a 9th game, at least not yet. But this is not, at least from what we can infer yesterday and from what we heard yesterday in the press conferences and in the media availability and the statements that have been released, this is not a permanent solution, but rather a stopgap for the SEC as they continue to evaluate the scheduling, essentially kicking the can down the road. In other words, the SEC, they wanted to avoid having to force its members to buy out of all their previously scheduled, 2024 non-conference games, because that was going to happen if they moved to 9 games. Every one of the 16 schools would have had to buy themselves out of one non-conference game. For Tennessee, that would have been Kent State. They had a clause in that agreement, and if the SEC would have moved to a 9-game schedule, Tennessee would have still had to have paid them out of the game, and the other 15 schools were in that situation too. So didn't want to force teams to buy out of those games on the schedule. Also didn't, want to make that decision yet, as they still kind of gather information about how the 12-team playoff will view strength of schedule, which I think is fair. At some point with there being 12 available spots, do you really need to up it to 9 games? Do you really need to throw in that 9th game to bolster your status when there are already, again, 12 spots, probably easier for teams to get in? So I think they want to gather information there. And then I think the biggest thing, even though they won't say it's the biggest thing, is they're still trying to squeeze ESPN for more money.
That is
money. Yeah, money is what makes the world go round. It's not black and white, it's green.
Especially in college football.
Yeah, and right now the ESPN doesn't technically owe the SEC more if they move from 8 to 9 games. They do owe them more when Texas and Oklahoma join, but the SEC wants more money from ESPN to add a 9th game. And ESPN, they're struggling a little bit financially themselves. They're going through another round of layoffs, so they're not really in a situation where they want to just say, hey, here, sure, more money, you can have it, when they've already committed a certain amount of money and they're contractually obligated to be with ESPN for, I think it's a decade, so.
Yeah, it's a long contract and it's a ton of money. And this was the right move, like creating this stopgap, kicking the can down the road, as you say, and gather all the necessary information. Like, find out, is the ninth game going to increase revenue? Figure out where it leaves you in the playoff voting. And the thing is, you can always add the ninth game. But if they went ahead and voted for the nine-game schedule today, it is much harder to come back to eight later, which is not... It's impossible. When they go to nine games, you can't then go back.
I think this does make sense for the SEC.
Yeah, it was the right move for today.
To go to eight games. And, I mean, it's frustrating that they can't make a decision. And they're taking a lot of heat today in the media. A lot of people criticizing the SEC, both for not moving to nine games. And you know, that's been called a cowardly look optically for the SEC. And then just also for being so indecisive. I don't think it's cowardly to stay at eight games. Again, made this point earlier this week, but when you're playing in the SEC, like, that's, there are no breaks. There are no breaks physically. There are no breaks emotionally. It's unlike other conferences where you just have bottom feeders that are essentially, you know, like some of your bye games. Right. So I get why the SEC doesn't want to move to nine games for that standpoint too. Like, you could just risk knocking yourself out of the playoff. I mean, if you're Tennessee, you could go 10-2 playing eight SEC games, and you know, that 10th win could be Kent State, and that could get you into a 12-team playoff. Or, you know, you could drop that Kent State game and go on the road to play LSU, lose, drop down to 9-3, and all of a sudden,
yeah, it's a different
could
story.
Still maybe slide into that 11th or 12th spot, but you're sweating it out. Whereas if you're 10-2 and you're Tennessee, you're safely in a 12-team playoff. And that's not just Tennessee. That's most of the SEC, just using Tennessee as an example there. So I understand wanting to stay at eight games. The only negative for me at staying with eight games, the thing that I think, you know, is you should be critical of, if anything, is that you're – just going to lose traditional rivalries to a certain extent. With eight games, only one protected rivalry and seven rotating opponents, there are just too many long-standing rivalries to be able to appease all of them.
Yeah, it's a historic conference. There's a lot of teams that don't like each other, but they love playing each other, right? And every fan base wants to watch them. But as I said, like, it doesn't close the door on nine games down the road. And if it's a couple years of losing a couple rivalries, it's only going to boost ratings once they come back. And as you said, like, it's going to be the rotating, you know, seven games. They're still going to play some of these teams. Like, it's still going to work out that they're going to see each other and match up. But, yeah, I mean, the protected rivalry thing, it's just frustrating. I stand on the side of, I want more good games. I want more competitive games. So I want a nine-game SEC conference schedule. And I also don't want the protected rivalry for Tennessee to just be Vandy. I get that that makes it easier to get to a playoff and win title games. But, like, there was a lot of value in having to overcome and slay the dragon of Alabama last year. And you get another chance to do it again this year. And, like, I don't want to see that go necessarily. And I think eventually it will all be worked out. Like, in the long run, the SEC is looking for the best TV product. It is so driven by the money that is generated from the TV contracts that eventually I think they will get to the nine games. They will bring back some of these rivalries if they are lost. And in the end, it's going to be still the most competitive and the most compelling college football conference.
I still think we end up at nine games eventually.
Yes, there's no doubt.
And eventually it could just mean 2025, because again, this is just a one-year stopgap.
Right.
They could keep it going, but for now it's just a one-year thing. So the rotating opponents honestly doesn't even matter in this specific instance, because there is no rotation in 2025. You're not going to play the other seven. So this almost has a 2020 feel to it.
Yeah.
Basically, where you played a 10-game conference schedule in the SEC, just
patch it together.
Made schedules up just made them out of the blue and tried to balance them out. And there were definitely schedules that were unbalanced. There were people that were upset. I have a feeling it's going to be the same way. Don't think Tennessee was treated all that fairly when they announced the 10-game schedules. I thought Tennessee had to play a pretty tough schedule.
Well, that's without a doubt, but just if you play anybody with a 10-game SEC schedule, it's going to be tough, but yeah.
I thought that Tennessee was almost treated a little bit unfairly when they tried to balance some of the schedules out. I'll be interested to see if this time around, now that Tennessee has reestablished itself as a national brand and a good football team again, and all the momentum we saw build for this program last year with a 10-2 year, and you know, you're selling out all your season tickets and everyone wants to watch you and there's country songs about you and all the Northeast finest girls, they don't want to go to Alabama right now. They want to go to Tennessee where Morgan Wallen sings songs about how pretty you are.
That's exactly right.
Tennessee, I mean, you are that big national brand now. So I wonder if they'll get that kind of treatment from the SEC come June 14th, because on June 14th, that's soon. June 14th, not next Wednesday, but the Wednesday after, on SEC Network, there will be a reveal special. We will find out who everyone's playing in 2024.
Right.
So, you know, you'll technically get a permanent rival, but it's not like it matters, because it's not like unless you stay with that 8-game SEC schedule in 2025. I guess it would be an indicator either way of, you know, if you move to 9, this would be one of your 3, or if you stay at 8, hey, this will probably be your 1, but essentially, we're just going to get some schedules made up for us and delivered to us on June 14th. Greg Sankey did say it would preserve traditional rivalries. He didn't necessarily confirm, you know, any specifics, but
yeah,
one can infer that you'll get Texas and Texas A&M, you'll get Auburn, Georgia, you'll get Alabama and Tennessee. If you're Tennessee, I think you can assume if with this 2024 8-game schedule that is being drafted by the SEC, I think it's fair to assume you're going to play Kentucky, Vanderbilt, and Alabama.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say, yeah. Yeah, and as they should, as I said, they are trying to sell a TV product, and one of the best episodes of their television season this year is the Bama-Tennessee matchup. It is advantageous for them to have that on the schedule. It's going to happen for sure.
I'll be very curious to see what the rest of the schedule looks like, but and I'll be curious too. Will they just still the teams that you played this year in 2023? If you play them again in 2024, I wonder if they'll still flip the home and away, or if they'll just reset it. Like, I wonder if there's a possibility that, you know, Tennessee plays in Lexington 2 years in a row, or right, you know, Vanderbilt plays in Neyland 2 years in a row, or we go to Tuscaloosa twice in a row. Hope not, but I think that could potentially happen. Your 5 other spots, though, some questions. I wonder, you know, could Tennessee end up facing Oklahoma anyway? They were supposed to in 2024.
Yeah, and I was looking forward to that game.
I was very much looking forward to that game. Will we get UT versus UT?
Yeah, I would love that.
I hope so.
Yeah.
UTA. Got to make sure that's established now.
And
you're
clear
in the SEC. Yeah, you're UTA now. Yeah, congratulations.
Yeah. No, I'm with you on that.
Wonder, you know, are we less likely to play Texas A&M or LSU or Ole Miss, since those are the 3 West schools that Tennessee's played most recently? Do you lose, you know, what SEC East rivalries that you've kind of sort of created, you know, will you lose? I don't think you'll get Florida and Georgia, you know, South Carolina, Missouri too. You're not going to play all 4 of those schools.
Yeah, you would hope South Carolina and Missouri are the ones that drop, just if, you know, just from the historical aspect of it. If you want to play the best, I would rather have Florida and Georgia remain.
Yeah, I still think it's inevitable that come 2025, it's going to be a 9-game schedule. I think it'll happen that soon. But it's created at least a fun kind of in-between year with 8 games and these mystery schedules. And
yeah, you don't know what's going to be there.
Guess what? I'm going to be locked in on June 14th. I will be on my couch 10 minutes ahead of time, tune into SEC Network on the edge of my seat to figure out what the schedule looks like in over a year.
Yeah, exactly.
The SEC rules over us all, and they know it. And, you know, they know what they can do.
Yeah, and again, it is a television show. That is another thing that they can broadcast on their network and have you tune in. And you know what? When they move it to the 9-game schedule and they have to do all this again, we will tune in again. It is something that if you care about a team in the SEC, you want to see how other teams are treated, as you said, who is on that top tier getting the respect, who you are playing, who your rivals are playing, who are the best of the best playing in the SEC, and what is the path to an SEC title. It means so much. It just means more, Charlie, bottom line. And we will watch, we will tune in to schedule reveals, prediction shows, the whole thing. They do, as you said, have complete control of the Southern football fan. Probably for the better, in my opinion. It's the best football conference. It's the most entertaining, most compelling, highest level of competition, best players, best coaching. Why shouldn't we pay attention and tune into everything they do?
I'll be curious to see who gets the short end of the stick, though, because just with the SEC, the way it is, someone will.
Yeah, somebody's going to have a tough 2 Wednesdays from now.
Yeah, someone's getting a tougher schedule than somebody else. And
always.
It feels, you know, I hope it's Kentucky. I hope they get the tough schedule. they've had it too easy for too long. Kentucky and Georgia, skating make by. Them just play everybody.
Yeah. Skating by in Lexington.
Oh. You guys have to play big, bad Mississippi State every year, and you still somehow lose every time.
Yeah, yeah. Cry about it. But Will Levis was, you fired up for Will Levis?
I don't like to talk about Will Levis.
I figured that's the only reason I asked.
Yeah, Will Levis makes me sad.
That's all right.
Maybe next time.
We got a whole summer, brother. We can talk about Will Levis. But, yeah, I mean, I'm fired up. There's nothing better than, like, when you get the bracket after the selection show for March Madness. The NFL schedule reveals, obviously, with all the great social media content that comes out of that. And the SEC schedule reveal will be just as entertaining.
At the end of the day, though, I still think 8 games is very fair. I've seen people say play 9. I've seen people say, you know, you need to play tougher games, that, you know, these games aren't doing anything for you. These bye games are unnecessary. They're not fun for the fans. I'm still – the SEC is hard enough as it is. I am good with 4 bye games. Give me 4 non-conference games. Again, you still have to play 1 Power 5 opponent, so, you know, that's – a 9th tougher game, but give me those 3 bye games. Give me the games against Kent State and Akron and Ball State and all these different MAC schools and Sun Belt schools, and let's take our wins and get our rest. You know, I care far less about what's entertaining for me, in respect to Tennessee having the best possible competitive advantage. You know, I would, as a fan, gladly give up 1 extra fun game a year to go play Akron if it means that, you know, Tennessee will have more success in terms of their postseason potential, in terms just of long-term success too, and you know, the wins that you collect. I would rather beat up on Akron to go 10-2 than lose a tight one in a really fun SEC game and go 9-3. Because, again, that can be the difference in making the playoffs. So I'm cool with the rest that you get, and I'm cool with the free wins. Maybe that's a loser's mentality. I don't know. But, again, SEC is tough enough already. I'm cool with it. I'm out. But conversation now shifts to, you know, what the SEC schedule will look like, to what the SEC schedule will look like, you know, from 8 to 9 games to, all right, now who are these 8 games? And I'm sure we'll have plenty of fun speculating over the next 12 days, but catch a break here. We'll get into the NBA Finals on the other side. Stay with us on the Blitz.
Finally, the drive is coming back to Rickard Ridge Barbecue in Campbell County, and this time we're coming.
strange lady. She made me nervous. She took me in and gave me breakfast. And she said, do you come from a land down under?
Well, you might have been right, Matthew.
What about, Charlie? There's so many things that I feel I was right about.
Nuggets might have been a little bit too much for Miami last night. Rust versus rest. Well,
they both looked a little rusty, honestly, though.
I don't know, dude. The Nuggets haven't missed a shot since Mother's Day.
It may have just been rest versus tired. No, they've been the best offense in the playoffs, and it's not even close.
They don't miss shots at all, ever, period. And it's kind of annoying.
Yeah, well, when you generate so many wide open ones with the Jokic thing, you make a lot of them.
Talked yesterday, you know, to give Jokic single coverage, let him be the one to beat you, you know, take your poison and try to take away everybody else. Said, hey, if Jokic has 40 but he takes 20 shots, that's fine. But the days that he has 26 points and 12 shots and a triple-double,
yep,
those are the bad days.
Yep.
Well, guess how many shots he had last night.
12 shots.
And guess how many points he had?
26?
27.
27.
And he had that triple-double, 10 rebounds, and 14 assists. Those are the Jokic games that are deadly, because that means everyone else is having a good night. And you look, Jamal Murray had 26 on 11 of 22. Aaron Gordon was 7 of 10. Michael Porter had 14. Bruce Brown was 4 of 7 off the bench. Just high-level shot-making last night from the Denver Nuggets, especially in the paint.
Yeah.
You knew going into the series that the Nuggets were the bigger team, but until you really saw it on the court, just at every single position, the Nuggets wider, taller, stronger. It's a tough matchup for Miami.
The size is a problem.
But Jokic had the kind of game we said he couldn't. And when he does, you're just not going to get a W if you're Miami. And the biggest thing for me, though, more than what the Nuggets did, the Heat all postseason long have gotten excellent contributions from their role players.
Yeah.
And in the playoffs, I mean, that's part of what they talk about. Role players show up at home, and that's kind of the boost you get at home, but they don't always travel well, and vice versa. Miami's role players have traveled very, very well throughout the postseason. They've shown up on the road in Milwaukee, on the road in New York, and on the road in Boston, and have shown up in some of the biggest moments. Well, last night, that was not the case. For the first time this postseason, the Miami Heat's role players kind of disappeared, kind of faded into oblivion, kind of got lost in the spotlight a little bit. And, you know, maybe it is just a case of playing four more games than your opponent in a week stretch,
right,
and going on the road on short rest to play in high altitude. But outside of Gabe Vincent, who played a great game last night, and Haywood Highsmith, who earned some minutes, I mean, Caleb Martin was 1 of 7. Max Strus was 0 of 10. Duncan Robinson was 1 of 6. And Kyle Lowry didn't make some shots until late either. He finished 4 of 8, but got off to an abysmal start. Even Jimmy, you know, not a role player, he had 13 too. That doesn't help. But when you look at those role players, and I mean, Caleb Martin and Max Strus combining to go 1 of 17, you're not going to win a basketball game that way.
No,
you're just not talented enough otherwise to overcome that kind of performance. And they were great looks. You know, it wasn't like they were forcing threes. It wasn't like they were chucking up shots. I mean, Max Strus missed 9 threes. I'd say out of those 9 threes, 6 of them were open.
Yeah.
And, you know, not just NBA open, but open.
Right, yeah. No, they generated good shots, just none of them fell. I think a lot of it had to do with the altitude. Something you had mentioned, you just got to rely on your stars more on the road. Jimmy only had 3 fourth-quarter field goals, which was shocking because Miami did make a run to start that fourth quarter. They start out on an 11-0 run, claw their way back in the game, and if you've watched this team all playoffs, specifically against the Celtics, you see that happening, and you're like, oh, man, we've seen this story before. The difference is that every time it happened, Denver was able to say, okay, enough of this. It's time to generate a good shot. And they got into some kind of action. They ran their two-man stuff. They let Jokic, you know, run the offense. And they got to a really high percentage shot down the stretch to kind of keep them at arm's length. Now, you could look at that 11-0 start to the fourth quarter and say, like, oh, they figured something out there. I think that's a little deceiving. We've seen at times, you know, we saw it for an entire stretch of a couple weeks with this Denver team at the end of the season where they were like, all right, let's kind of gear down a little bit. I think there was a little bit in that in last night in that game. And, you know, just taking your foot off the gas is easy to do when you're up 20, you know, between that 15 to 20 range, and you're in the coming into the fourth quarter. So I wouldn't look at that as like the Heat figured something out. I look at that more as the Denver Nuggets taking their foot off the gas. But I was still impressed with their ability to not let it get to 6 or let it get to 5. They let it get to 10, and then they said, all right, let's get back into our stuff that got us here, and we're still able to, you know, there was one Jokic bucket, there was a Jamal Murray bucket, and then there was 2 drawn fouls by both of them as well. There was an almost shot clock violation where Michael Porter Jr. just had to chuck one up. But for the most part, like, once Miami had cut it to 10-9, that range, Denver was still able to kind of put their arm out and say, all right, we're still going to win this game by double digits.
They're just so consistent in what they do, too.
Yeah.
I mean, just a, you know, Spoelstra called this a mirror image series. I think that was a little complimentary to his Heat. You know,
the talent
level isn't necessarily mirror image, but I think there is a lot of similarities in the way that they both of these teams just stay very true to their identities. They're both very consistent in what they do. They don't really let each other dictate what they do, I guess, too much. I think they're both just very, like, level-headed teams. Did kind of notice that last night. It just felt like very smooth-paced, evenly-paced game. Both teams just kind of going at it, getting their stuff clean, pretty clean game. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Heat shot 2 free throws.
That's another problem, yes. And that's
got to find a way to get to the line.
And that matched the eye test, too. It wasn't a bad whistle, in my opinion.
I didn't think so either.
Yeah, they just were not generating the contact that they had throughout this playoffs.
I mean, I thought like maybe there were like 2 or 3 times that Denver got a little touchy foul and the Heat didn't in terms of shooting fouls. But
right.
I mean, I thought the Heat had some like loose ball whistles go their way, too. So I thought it was a well-officiated game.
Yeah, the definitely.
It's the Heat's responsibility to draw some more fouls.
Right.
Moving forward, but I'm not discouraged at all, honestly. I thought that the Heat kind of found something a little bit with that zone later on. They're definitely going to need Denver, you're going to make Denver adjust based on the kind of game that Bam had. They kept finding him plenty of space in the middle of the floor. Miami, again, I thought they got a ton of great looks.
Definitely.
All
yeah.
night.
Yeah,
and if those fall, Miami wins game one.
Right.
So, again, it's a difficult situation to be in. You know, you're the road team with the rest disadvantage against the best team in the NBA right now. But you had opportunities last night despite everything that kind of worked against you. I think that, I mean, at this point, why would I doubt it? I think that Miami can jump right back into this series and just start making those same shots again and be fine. You know, if you can find a way to win game 2, then you had a very, very, very successful start to this series.
Right, yeah.
Anything other than going back to Miami down 2-0 is a huge win for Miami. So,
and I don't think being down 2-0 means it's over either.
Mm-mm. See, it doesn't start until you lose at home.
Denver stinks on the road also.
Yeah, series doesn't start until you lose at home. Again, yeah, not discouraged by any means, but the margin for error is just so thin. It's so much more thin than it was against Milwaukee. It's so much more thin than it was against New York. And it's so much more thin than it was against Boston, because the Nuggets aren't going to make the same mistakes that those three teams made. They're
right.
just a cleaner, better coached team. They're not going to turn the ball over. They're not going to get lost defensively. So you just have to execute at an even higher level. And quite frankly, you're going to have to score some points. There's no slowing the Nuggets down. You just don't have the size to guard Nikola Jokic, and you don't really have the size to guard Aaron Gordon either, it proves. So, you know, there's going to be looks there for Denver, and they're going to convert on a lot of them. Miami is going to have to score with them. But game one went to Denver, and again, could have been a lot more discouraging for Miami. Pretty good fourth quarter, all things considered, too. But hour one's done. Hour two's on deck, and hour two will be joined in person by Logan Quinton. I think he's bringing some crumble cookies through as well.
Wow.
Big hour two coming. We'll dive into the baseball side of things. Stay with us here on the Blitz.
Finally, the drive is coming back to Rickard Ridge Barbecue in Campbell County.